Okay, this is lesson one to covenant. With lesson one of covenant, she begins by just hip-hopping across the top of the water the way you would skip a rock across, just to give us a bird's eye view, an overview of many of the covenants, the three major ones and a couple others that we'll be looking at. But when I was doing the homework, I thought that it would be a good idea for us to back up just a little bit more and start at the beginning rather than with Noah. Last week, when we were considering the reasons why we should study covenant, I showed this slide. I said, everything God does is based on covenant. And I said, sometimes it's hidden in shadows or it's veiled by our ignorance, but it's there for us to discover. And eventually the film can be lifted off our eyes so that we can see what is there to be seen. But in fact, God's dealing with man in terms of covenant began at the beginning. God made a type of covenant with Adam. It's not explicitly called a covenant. It was a commandment with conditions that should be obeyed. It was a covenant of works in this sense. God set out the parameters of the behavior that he expected from Adam and from Eve, and then he told them that if they broke his terms, his commandments, his covenant, that there would be consequences. Now, remember that Adam and Eve were not like us. They were perfect. They had true free will. They had full possession of their faculties, and their faculties were probably a whole lot clearer than ours are, because ours are clouded by our fallen and sinful nature. So if they had free will, they had the ability to obey or to disobey truly God's commandment. But Eve was influenced by an evil that was outside herself. It was not within her. It was with outside herself. And she was beguiled. She was seduced. And so after that, then Adam deliberately exercised his free will to rebel against God. So that's the way the Bible begins in Genesis 3 with the story of the fall after the creation story. Well, why is this account? I said story, it's really an account. Why is this account of the fall in Genesis 3? Why am I bringing that up in a study that has to do with covenant? And the answer is because God revealed his purposes in redemption in the form of a covenant. All that we will be doing relates to covenant. The Almighty and the Eternal God turned to the man who had rebelled against him and turned on him, and he began to tell him what he was going to do. God began to tell Adam what he was going to do to solve the problem of their separation. He began to implement the plan that he had formulated from before the foundation of the world. Remember that God was not taken by surprise when Adam sinned. And in a manner of progressive revelation, which is what the Bible is, you begin with just a little bit and then you build a little at a time, precept upon precept, line upon line, until you have the full revelation, which we, living after the canon of the New Testament was completed, have the full benefit of. And in this, he introduced his covenant of grace, which was going to be his chosen manner of redeeming man, buying him back, saving him from the condemnation that resulted from man's turning on him. Now, in various books that you may read, you will find references to covenant of redemption, covenant of salvation, covenant of grace. All of these are referring to exactly the same thing. This is God's eternal plan from before the foundation of the world. They're all talking about how he's going to save man from the guilt and condemnation that resulted when Eve listened to the lies of Satan. And the great promise of this covenant is there at the bottom of the screen. I will be their God, and they will be my people. If you are aware of that phrase, it will pop out at you every time you come across it, and you'll see it frequently, not just in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament as well. That is the great covenant promise. Now, God had been Adam's God, and then Adam rebelled against him and broke the covenant relationship that he and Eve and God had enjoyed. And at that point then, Adam and Eve became the slaves of Satan. They fell under the dominion of Satan, and they were no longer under the dominion of God. But God had a plan that was going to restore all that had been lost by the fall and then some, so that man could once again say that God was his God. And we know now, because we're at the other end of the picture where the full revelation has been given, that it would be based on the vicarious atonement of Jesus Christ. Now, the first appearance of this covenant of grace is in a very cryptic form. It's a bare whisper of something that's there. It's just a shadow of what is to come. But what it is the gospel in an embryonic form. It's the seed of the gospel that's there, and we can only see it because we're looking backward. God tells Satan, "And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed, and he shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel." Now you'll notice that in that sentence, that's verse 15 of Genesis chapter 3, the verse is divided by a semicolon. There are two sentences in there. So let's look at the first sentence first. The first thing that God tells Satan is that he's going to put enmity between Satan and the woman. Now remember that because the serpent had beguiled Eve, she was now under his dominion. They had a pretty good relationship now because now she was his slave. So the first thing that God had to do was break up this friendship, because she was meant for friendship with him. With God, not with Satan. So this in itself is the first announcement of salvation, that God's going to break up this relationship between the slave of sin and the master of sin. Man cannot be saved if he insists upon remaining a friend of the flesh, the world, and the devil. Because as long as he is a friend of the world, the flesh, and the devil, he is an enemy of God. So God has to make man his friend and an enemy of the devil. And so with this one sentence, we see that God is now dividing up all mankind into two categories: those who are the seed of the devil and those who are the seed of God. Now let's look at the second sentence, a little more cryptic. He shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. And I capitalized those H's. It may not appear as a capital H in your translation, but I did that to make it clear that we learn from the rest of the Bible that this is really a picture of Calvary. And we learn that the reference to the seed of the woman is a reference to Jesus Christ. We know this looking back. We didn't know this at the time. Remember, if you're just beginning to read the Bible and you read this, you're not going to see all of these things in there. And at that's a problem that the prophets often had too, is that they would be given these things to say by God and they wouldn't understand what it was they were saying or what the meaning of it might be. Daniel in particular, you remember, struggled with understanding what it was he was being given to say. So the revelation was progressive, but looking back, we can see that it is. The seed of the woman, well, women don't have seeds. We have eggs. So what it means when it says the seed of the woman is that the offspring will come only by her. There will be no concurrence of a man involved. What this is saying is that it will be a virgin birth. Right there in Genesis 3:15, you have the prophecy of a virgin birth. And we know who the offspring of that virgin birth is. It's Jesus Christ. And then we are told that Satan can bruise his heel. And when it's talking about his heel, commentators suggested it's talking about his lower nature. Remember that Jesus was fully God and fully man. And Satan, was able to have the man crucified. He actually did die. They put the spear in his side so that we have proof that he did die. So as a result, that is the bruising of the heel of Jesus Christ. But the bruising of the head, the crushing of the head of Satan, is a picture of total and ultimate destruction of Satan and of his power. So Genesis 3:15 then is a foreshadowing of this covenant of grace that's going to come about because Adam disobeyed that little covenant of works that he was fully able to keep but did not keep, chose not to keep, and in breaking that, separated man from God And at that point, then God introduced right there. This is in Genesis 3:15. It's at the time of the fall. It's at the time when he's saying, what happened? As if he didn't know. Of course, he knows. And Adam's busy blaming Eve, and Eve is busy blaming the serpent. And they're just, it's the blame game being passed around. Right at that time, God is announcing in a very bare whisper of a form that he has a plan to take care of this problem. Last week, I showed you this slide, and I said that K. Arthur wrote, covenant is the crimson thread woven throughout the fabric of God's truth from Genesis to Revelation. When you watch the tape today, she calls it scarlet. I think the reason she chose crimson when she was writing was because of the reference in Isaiah to our sins being as red as crimson, and we shall be cleaned as white as snow. But today she calls it scarlet. Whether it's scarlet or it's crimson, what is it? It's blood. It's a reference to blood. Now, I'm still stuck on that Adam and Eve story. I haven't really moved into the lesson yet, but I have a reason for it. When Adam and Eve sinned, God made garments of skin for them and clothed them, and then he threw them out of the garden. And he stationed the angel with the flaming sword at the east of Eden so that they could not come back in and have access to the tree of life. It says he made garments of skin. Well, from what? The implication, the inference that we may draw from it is that he must have killed animals and taken their skins and used them to cover Adam and Eve. So this is the first picture of the innocent dying on behalf of the guilty. Right away, we have this picture of sacrifice one for another, because animals can't sin. They don't have consciousness the way we do, so they cannot. And this symbolized several things. The first was this picture of the innocent dying for the sinners. The second was that sin had to be dealt with, and that it would only be covered for a while, and it would not be sent away, merely covered. And the third thing was that after sin came into the world, the spilling of blood was the only way to approach God again. Do you wonder why? Why is the shedding of blood the only way to approach God? This just seems a little bit unnerving to think of blood having to be shed in order to approach God. And the reason why is because the shedding of blood is what meets the requirements of laws that God set forth in his word. So let's look at a couple of them. We know that because God is holy, sin cannot enter into his presence, right? And Romans 3:23 tells us, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So all of us are sinners. So none of us have the right to be in the presence of a holy God. And then also Romans 5:12-21, which is a description of the contrast between what we were in Adam and what we are in Christ. When it's talking about Adam, it says that death has reigned from the time of Adam until Moses. Even before the giving of the law, death reigned as a result of Adam's one sin, a contravention of a commandment of God. And what we know about God's law is that the penalty for sin is death. I'm going to read some select phrases, clauses, and sentences out of these verses of Romans 6. I'm just focusing on what's in the bold. When you were slaves of sin, which is what we were before we were in Christ, it is what we are before we are in Christ, it says the outcome of those things, and those things refers to what we do because we're under the dominion of Satan, which is sin, because that's all we know how to do. We really don't have much choice in the matter. For the wages of sin is death, it says. So we know that we are all sinners. That's been made plain to us, and we know it in our hearts anyway. We know that sin cannot exist in the presence of a holy God. And so how are we going to get back to God? And God sets it out. In Leviticus, he says, the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have given it, the blood of the creature, to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. The life of every creature is its blood. Since life is in the blood, if you shed blood, and you shed enough of the blood, what's going to result? Death. The shedding of blood indicates that you have taken a life and that you have therefore made a sacrifice. And we also know from the New Testament, remember, we have the full revelation of God. Hebrews 9:22, without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins. There is no putting away. There is no forgiveness of sins. We're not talking about covering. We're talking about sending sins away. Without the shedding of blood, it's not going to happen. If the penalty for sin should be paid and paid in full, then God's justice would be satisfied. God is a just and holy God. He cannot overlook sin. And if he did, we wouldn't think he was very just. If a judge in the human realm were to let off a murder and say, oh, it's okay. I know that, it may have been premeditated and planned out, but it's okay. I want you to like me anyway. I'm a good guy. So I'm going to let you off. We wouldn't feel that he was a very just judge. And in the same way, God's justice is not something that can be winked at. It must be fulfilled, because otherwise God would not be just. And so if the penalty of a law that has been broken is paid, then God's justice is satisfied. At the end of Romans chapter 3, it talks about the law being established. How do you establish a law? You do it by enforcing the penalty that is associated with breaking that law. Well, if a penalty for sin could be paid in full, then God's justice would be satisfied. The problem is, we can't. Fallen man is spiritually bankrupt. He has nothing to offer. He cannot make a perfect payment. The perfect sacrifice that is required to make sin be taken care of, to send it away. By the way, remit means to send away. Remission of sin, to send away. Literally, to send it away. And so we cannot satisfy God's perfect justice. I've got Hebrews 10, 1 through 4 up there. It says, for the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come and not the very form of things, can never, by the same sacrifices year by year, which they offer continually, it can never make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, if it could, would it not have ceased to be offered, because the worshipers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have a consciousness of sin? But in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins year by year, for it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin. And verse 11 says, every priest stands daily ministering and offering time after time the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. The sacrificial system of the Old Testament was a picture, of course, of the ultimate sacrifice that would be made in time. But it was also, it says here in Hebrews, a reminder of sins year by year. Consider that at certain times of the year, at certain festivals, the Jewish men were all required to come to Jerusalem. They were required to come for various things, for example, after the birth of a baby, the purification and all of that. But at certain times, all these men were coming in, and they're all bringing their sacrifices in, and they all have to be sacrificed. Here are these priests in these gorgeous, sterling, lovely linen robes, and they've got to kill these animals. I think they mostly did it by slashing the throat. And you can imagine what happens. You know, it goes spurting everywhere. Well, they don't just slaughter one animal. They're doing it all day long. By the end of a couple of hours, these linen robes would be soaked in blood. There would be gore and blood all over the floor, everywhere. Can you imagine? It would stink like a slaughterhouse. In God's temple, this beautiful white gleaming building just covered with blood and gore and smell. It would be awful. And the reason was, it was a reminder of sin. That's how offensive sin is to the nostrils of God. It offends his sensibilities as it should offend ours. In Hebrews 10:12, it tells us that only the death of an unblemished lamb, only a perfect sacrifice, can be a perfect payment that will fulfill the requirement and satisfy God's holy justice. And more than cover sin, it will take it away. And so Hebrews tells us first in chapter 10, verse 5, I didn't cite that, but in that one it says God prepared a body for Jesus Christ so that he could come and be the perfect lamb who would take away the sins of the world. And then these verses 12 and 14 say, he, Jesus Christ, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God. Now that points out another thing. We just said that the priests had to do their duty and it never ended. You notice that there was no furniture anywhere in the tabernacle or anywhere in the temple that even remotely resembled a chair. That's because the priests were not allowed to sit down when they were doing their duties, because their duties never ended. Christ did it once. He did it once for all. It was perfect. It was finished. And he sat down. Verse 14 says, by one offering, he has perfected for all time those who are sanctified. And just as an aside, think about hell. Have you ever wondered why it has to last for eternity? I mean, if the shedding of blood is to pay for sin and you die, isn't that death enough? And the answer is no. You could live an eternity of lifetimes and pay an eternity of deaths, and it won't be enough. Why? Because it's just like the sacrifices in the temple. It's not a perfect sacrifice. It's an imperfect sacrifice, because we are imperfect people, and therefore we can never meet the requirement. The payment will never be paid in all of eternity. Now, if that isn't a sobering and scary thought, I don't know what other thought could be. Only the shedding of the blood of Jesus Christ can satisfy the requirements of God's law and make a propitiation for sinners. We talked about that in Romans 3, those of you who studied that. Propitiation means that it is an act which averts the wrath of God, turns it aside, and more than that, it restores us to relationship with him. So a propitiation does all that we need to have done for us and are perfectly imperfectly unable to do for ourselves. Only he can do it for us. But now I'm going back to Adam and Eve again. I'm still stuck on them. It was God himself who made that first sacrifice and killed the first animals to cover, not put away, cover the sins of Adam and Eve when they sinned. It was a picture of the future sacrifice of his perfect lamb that he would use to take away, perfectly put away, the sins of the world. So he's giving us, that's what I love about the Old Testament. I'm a very concrete thinker, and everything in the Old Testament is a concrete, literal thing that happens, and it's a picture of the spiritual thing that will happen in the time when Jesus Christ should come in the fullness of time. So then we have another foreshadowing, and this will happen when we're looking at Abraham, although it's not part of the Abrahamic covenant. This is another foreshadowing of God himself preparing and sending the perfect sacrifice for the sins of the world. This was the story of Isaac and Abraham, where Abraham was ordered to sacrifice his son, his only son, whom he loved. And they went up there, and as they were about to start the trek up Mount Moriah, Isaac turns to his father and he says, well, here's the fire and here's the wood. Where's the sacrifice? And Abraham answers prophetically, God will provide for himself the lamb. And then you can see there the picture of the angel stopping his hand and pointing over the shoulder of Abraham to point out the ram in the thicket. So God indeed did spare Isaac, and he provided himself the animal for the sacrifice, just as he will provide for us the lamb of sacrifice. So we started at the beginning. Sin separated man from God. And the spilling of blood is the only way thereafter to approach God. So that means the only way that man and God can be in relationship again, can have relationship restored to them then, is through shed blood. So now we're going to start looking at the elements of covenant that you looked at in your homework. And you're going to find that this element of shed blood is a critical one that you're going to find in almost every one of them. Some of the elements are not common to all of them, but the shed blood seems to be quite common. In fact, this concept of spilled blood is inherent in the definitions of the Hebrew words for make and for covenant. In the homework, she asked us to look up the definitions in Hebrew for make. Karath, to cut off a body part, to cut out, to eliminate, to kill, to cut a covenant. Now, I chose that picture of the man cutting the chicken in half because we're going to see with the Abrahamic covenant that Abraham was required to cut the animals in half. Now, he didn't have nice kitchen shears like that. I'm sure he had to use a knife and hack them. But the point is the same. The picture is the same. So when you think of make, think of cut. How about covenant, the Hebrew word for covenant? Berith. That's the Hebrew word, berith. It comes from berah, which means to cut. Guess what else berah means? To create by separation. In the beginning, God created. That's the word berah. He created by separating the light from the darkness, the land from the sea, the earth, you know, set the earth in the midst of the firmament, all of that. It's the same word there. But it means the word bereath picks up the cutting, the separating nuance of the other word, which has a broader meaning. And it means a compact made by passing between pieces of flesh, a covenant, a league, an alliance, a pledge, a confederacy. Remember last week I showed you this slide and I said that originally what we call the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, were written in Hebrew. And then because the Jews forgot their Hebrew and they spoke Greek, that it was translated in between 300 and 200 BC into the Septuagint. And then a couple hundred years later, in the first century, the New Testament was written, and it was also written in Greek. And I said that the Greek word in the Septuagint and also in the New Testament was picked up the word of covenant that also means last will and testament. And so that when St. Jerome was translating the Greek into Latin in the fourth century, it was into the Latin Vulgate, he picked up that nuance of last will and testament, and he called covenant testamentum. So we could have an old covenant or a new covenant, as well as calling it an Old Testament and a New Testament. The reason I'm bringing this up again today is because scholars say that in the Septuagint and in the New Testament and in the Latin Vulgate, the choice of the Greek word that picks up the nuance of last will and testament was deliberate. It was purposeful. And their reason for choosing that meaning of the word was that when God covenanted with man after the fall, this was not two equal parties negotiating and finally coming to a meeting of the minds. It wasn't like that at all. It was God giving his covenant to man. So the use of the word testament instead of covenant is really quite logical, because ultimately all our blessings that we ever get come to us because of the death of Jesus Christ. Hebrews tells us, and we know it, a will isn't effective until the person who made it, till the testator, dies. We also know that it is in this sense that we inherit everything. It's a result of a death that we get the benefits that are under the will and testament, if you want to say it that way, of Jesus Christ. So now let's look at that Greek word for covenant or testament. Diatheke. It's a disposition, you're disposing of something, either by contract or by bequest, a divisory will, a testament. And just so you know, a bequest in a will is a giving of a thing, and a devise is a giving of money. So it's a disposition of something by bequest, divisory will, a testament. A will, of course, is completely unilateral, and it is not the result of negotiation unless there's been undue influence applied ahead of time, which we're assuming is not the case here. So for our purposes then, when we're talking about covenant, what we're talking about is a formal, solemn, binding, irrevocable, means it cannot be revoked. And by the way, something that can't be revoked also can't be changed. So if it's irrevocable, that's it. It's set in stone. It is an agreement that was often made in the past by walking between the pieces of torn flesh. Now, with that background, which took me 35 minutes to give you because I wanted to start at the beginning with Adam and Eve and the very first shedding of blood and the first sacrifice of the innocent for the sake of the guilty. Now let's start with the subject of Noah. That was the first thing that we talked about in the homework. Okay, who initiated this covenant? God. What was the sign of it? The rainbow. Was it unconditional or was it conditional? Unconditional. Man was not required to do anything. What was its length? What was its term? Forever. It was to be an everlasting covenant. Who were the beneficiaries of the covenant? God made it with whom? Noah and who else? His family and who else? All the animals, all the living things. So Noah, his family, and all living things were the ones with whom he covenanted, and therefore they are the beneficiaries of the covenant. That's about all the time that I want to spend on the Noahic covenant, because it doesn't really relate much to the covenant of grace that we're going to be talking about over the course of the semester. This was a subsidiary covenant. The original germ, the original nugget, the seed of the covenant of grace that God was going to use to redeem man to himself, restore man to himself, is given in Genesis 3:15. And then it's expanded more and clarified when we get to the Abrahamic covenant. In the interim, this covenant came, and it just made some legislation things that had nothing really to do with the covenant of grace. So that we're only talking about it for limited purposes. And so the next covenant that we look at is the covenant with Abraham, the Abrahamic covenant. Now, like Noah, Abraham, before he was Abraham, while he was still Abram, believed in the Lord, and he was a righteous man. And we saw that in Genesis 15, the Lord promised Abram, who was elderly but childless at the time, that he would have descendants as numerous as the stars. And then we read in Genesis 15:6 that Abram believed in the Lord, and the Lord reckoned it to Abram as righteousness. What we know from other studies in the Bible is that this means that at this point, God justified Abram. By faith at this point, Abram entered into covenant with God. And he also promised that these descendants would possess the land of Canaan. And Abram asked him, we're still in Genesis 15, Abram asked God, how would he know that his descendants would possess the land? And it's a little unclear from the way the text comes out, but there are possibly two responses. Because God says, know for certain that your descendants will be a land that is not theirs. They will be enslaved for 400 years. So that could be the answer. How will I know? Well, I'm going to give you a prophecy, and then you won't know because you won't be around, but it will happen. And this is how your descendants will know that this promise is true. But the other possibility is that his response to this question was the cutting of the covenant. Who initiated this covenant with Abraham? God. And then we are told that he was instructed to get all these animals and the birds, and he was told to cut the animals in two, but not the birds. And then he fell asleep, or was made to go to sleep. And then this smoking oven and flaming torch passed between the pieces. So who was it who walked between the torn pieces of the animals? God. Did the smoking oven and the flaming torch remind you of something that happened like 400 years later when they were wandering in the wilderness and what was leading them by day and by night? Yeah, the pillar of smoke and at night it was fire. And we always think of God as light anyway. So when it said a smoking oven and a flaming torch, that's what came to my mind, is that, well, this is not it may be the first time, but it's not the last time that God's going to appear in that particular form. Was the covenant conditional or unconditional? Unconditional. Okay. There were lots and lots of promises of the Abrahamic covenant. We're going to look at Genesis 15 first, and then we're going to look at Genesis 17 and see what promises we can get out of the Abrahamic covenant that were promised unconditionally by God to Abraham. Can you start just shooting out any of them? A son? In fact, that was the first one I put too. Countless descendants? Gosh, she's right on with me. What else? Land. What else? Everlasting. That's an important one. A shield and a very great reward. Okay, so far we've got an heir from his body, countless descendants, a great nation would come from him, a specifically divine land for this nation, and again, that 400-year slavery for his descendants, followed by a return to the promised land. Let's look at Genesis 17. Okay, let's just flip them up there. He would be the father of a multitude of nations. Some of his descendants would be kings. We know one in particular would be. Actually, we know of King David in the human line, and then in the Davidic, Also in the Davidic and the Divinic, there's no such word. Yes, Jesus. The promises were extended to the descendants everlastingly. Also, the land was given as an everlasting possession. Now, that should be an answer to anybody who says that Israel no longer has a right to the land. He would get a son by Sarah, and the covenant would pass through him. Now, this tells us something else. We're getting a fuller picture of this covenant that's introduced in Genesis 3:15. But at the same time that it's fuller, it's also narrowing down, because now God has picked out a man and a line of descendants through whom he's going to fulfill his promises. So in the same sense that it's expanding, it's also narrowing down. And what's the sign of this covenant? Not a rainbow for this covenant. What is it for this one? Circumcision is the one that is the sign of this covenant, and Abraham obeyed immediately. This was not in the homework, but in Genesis 18, Genesis 22, and Genesis 26, there were other promises that were given that had to do with the gospel promise that we're looking at, beginning with Genesis 3:15 and working our way through as we study covenant. So I wanted to pull those up. Through Abraham, all the nations, and the nation is also the word Gentiles, all of them on the earth would be blessed. And we know, because we're looking backwards, we've got the benefit of hindsight, that this promise is another and more explicit reference to the seed of the woman of Genesis 3:15. So the Abrahamic covenant then is definitely an expansion then of the little cryptic whisper of a promise that we have in Genesis 3:15. Another thing that happened with this covenant, besides the cutting of the animals in two and the smoking torch and all of that happening, is, and all of the promises that were being given, is that there was a name change that was associated with this covenant. And there was a name change of Abram to Abraham. Abraham means, anyone remember? Father of a multitude. That's exactly right. And Sarah means princess, because she would be a mother of nations and she would be a mother of kings. Kings would come from her. And remember, at this time, she had not yet given birth to a child at the time that her name was changed. Now, in the homework at this point, Kay Arthur said one of her Arthurisms that I just love. Remember how she'll say, if you see a therefore, then ask what it is there for. Well, this is another one of her favorite things. So I had to put it because in the homework, this is where it appeared. Hangeth thou in there. If you're getting discouraged digging through the Bible, then just hangeth thou in there. Thy perseverance will pay off. At this point in the homework, she switched gears and went from the Abrahamic covenant and started looking at men's covenants. I tried to follow the flow of the homework, but she did tend to go from covenants with God and man to covenants horizontally between men, and then she'd go back up, and then she'd go this way. So it may seem a bit disjointed, but that's because I'm trying to follow the flow of the homework. So we have now a covenant between men. We have a covenant between Abraham and Abimelech. It was based on Abimelech's fear of Abraham. Actually, it was really based on his fear of Abraham's God, because it was pretty clear that Abraham's God was blessing him and looking out for him. So this covenant, what were the terms of this covenant? Anyone remember? Between Abimelech and Abraham? That's exactly right. They would not deal falsely with one another, and that they would treat each other with kindness. And he had every reason to fear him. So he wanted that promise extracted from him. There was an exchange. Well, it looks like a pretty one-sided exchange. I didn't see that Abimelech gave Abraham anything, but Abraham gave sheep and oxen. And then he said he was giving 7 ewe lambs to be a witness. Now, what does he mean, a witness, a reminder of the covenant? And the answer is, every time you see those 7 ewe sheep, you're going to remember. You made a covenant with me, and you're going to deal well with me, deal with me with kindness. So that was a reminder that there would be. So we see now that they, in addition to the promises, the oaths that are exchanged, that they would deal well with one another, sometimes there was some sort of a witness or a memorial, like the 7 ewe lambs that were set up. In addition, Abraham planted a tamarisk tree and named the well at Beersheba. No, and the well at Beersheba was where he planted the tamarisk tree. And Beersheba means well of oaths. She told us that in the homework. I thought that was kind of interesting because that was where they exchanged oaths. So you have the name change here, too, so that you can remember what it is that happened at this place. Abimelech also made a covenant with Isaac after Abraham was out of the picture. And it was Abimelech who also initiated this covenant. Again, he was afraid of Isaac. Actually, he was afraid of Isaac's God. And there was an exchange of oaths between these men, too, a similar thing, that they would not deal falsely with one another, that they would deal with one another kindly. They had a feast and drank. We don't see that in the one with Abraham, but it is an element that's present in the one with Isaac. And then in the case of Abraham, he memorialized the covenant with several ways, with the 7 ewe lambs, with the well, and with the planting, renaming of the well, and the planting of the tamarisk tree. At this point, then, she skips back to vertical covenants between God and man. We know that he made the covenant with Abraham, and then he ratified it, not with Ishmael, the firstborn son, because Ishmael was born of Hagar, and we know that the promise is going to come through the son born through Sarah, and that is Isaac. At this point, then, he God ratifies the covenant with Isaac, but not with Ishmael. And so we have a further narrowing down now of this covenant. This covenant that began as a mere suggestion has now expanded out so that we know more about what the covenant is about, but it's been narrowed down to a man, and now it's been narrowed down even further to one of his descendants. It's going to go through his line. And then we get even further confirmation of that, that this covenant God made with Abraham and with Isaac is now going to be ratified with Jacob, who was later renamed Israel. And the 12 tribes of Israel were descended from him. The next covenant that we have is a covenant between Jacob and Laban. Did you all enjoy reading this account as much as I did? I mean, if ever two men deserved each other, it's these two. I don't know which one was the sneakier one. Sometimes I think it was Jacob, and sometimes when you read this passage, you probably think it's Laban. Because, you know, he ends up working 14 years to get the two sisters, and then Laban changes his wages 10 times, and they're constantly changing the deal. Okay, you get the sheep that have stripes, and I get the ones that have spots. No. Now it's going to be, you get the one that have spots and I get the one that, you know, they're constantly changing the terms of the employment arrangement. So these two richly deserved one another, I think. At any rate, so Jacob decides to run off in the night. How one did it in those days, I have no idea. I mean, it's not like he could go sneak off and catch a bus or a train, for goodness sakes. You had to pack up all the camels, and we're not just talking a couple of people. We're talking kids and servants and stuff. You got to move your whole household. You got to pack up the tents and the rugs and the cooking utensils, and who all knows what was involved in moving up. So somehow they managed to sneak off in the night. And, well, obviously Laban and Jacob did not live in the same camp. They obviously had separate camps, and they were apart from one another, but I just thought, I got a real kick out of reading that and thinking, all right, they snuck off in the night. Okay. Yeah, make a lot of racket. So their camps must have been very, very far apart indeed. So Laban goes chasing after Jacob and berates him soundly, and then they make a covenant together. And the basis of this covenant also is what? Fear. There's no love relationship between these two men. What is this saying? Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Well, they were very careful to do that because they knew just exactly what the other person was like, because he was just like himself. So they were very, very careful of one another. And Laban was basing this one on fear. And they promised that they would not harm one another. So Jacob then set up a pillar, a memorial of stones, to memorialize the covenant. He called it Galeed. Laban called it some unpronounceable thing. I have no idea what it's, how to pronounce it or what it means. And then in addition to calling it Galeed, he starts calling it Mizpah, which we know means watchtower. So it's called Watchtower Mizpah, and God was called to judge between Jacob and Laban. Now look at that picture. That's an artist's rendering of this stone that he's setting up. And yet, here's a very old photograph of one that was found east of the Dead Sea. Doesn't it look like it? Like the artist's rendering? I'm wondering if the artist was there and saw something like this and saw that maybe that was it. Mizpah is a witness of warning between them. Genesis 31 says, beginning at verse 49, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from another. If you mistreat my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between us, between you and me." So you see people who have these pieces of jewelry, and they think it's a blessing that God's going to watch over us while we're apart from one another. But in the context of how this appears, it's really a warning. I know what you're like, and I know what you do, and I want you to know God's watching you. Even if I'm not, He is, so you better watch out. Stay on the straight and narrow. Okay, the next covenant we're going to touch on very briefly is known by various names. It's called the Old Covenant. It's called the Covenant of the Law. It's called the Covenant of Moses. It's called the Mosaic Covenant. It's also just called the Law. All of these are all names for the same thing. Now, about 400 years have passed since Abraham originally made his covenant, or God made the covenant originally with Abraham. And so since more than 400 years have passed, we know that what God prophesied has come to pass. Joseph was responsible for getting all of the family into Egypt. There they multiplied, and then they were enslaved for 400 years. When the cup of the Egyptians' iniquity was full, then God said, okay, it's time to lead the people out and take them to the land that I originally promised to Abraham. So God established this old covenant, the law, with the nation of Israel through Moses. And when he did, Moses built an altar with 12 pillars representing the 12 tribes. And then they sacrificed animals. Here we have the spilled blood again. And he sprinkled half of the blood on the altar that he had made and the other half on the people. Now think back to the Abrahamic covenant. When they did that one, he hacked the animals in two and set them aside, and then the smoking oven and flaming torch went through. So this is a symbol kind of the splitting of the animal. The animal's been sacrificed, half the blood's going on the altar, half is going on the people, the half representing on the altar, rather representing God, and the half on the people representing them. And then in addition, we have a covenant meal that goes with it. Also, another reference that we were given was Exodus 34, 27, and 28. This is talking about the second tablets that were made. Remember, the first ones got broken because he came down and there was this golden calf incident that happened and he lost his temper and smashed them. Well, so then he had to go back up and get a second set made. And when he came down with those, these are the same ones. They have the Ten Commandments on them. But in this passage, it's called the Covenant of the Law. Or the Old Covenant. I like that, Covenant of the Law. We think of it as Old Covenant, and that's fine, but it's also called the Covenant of the Law. Again, we've got these covenant elements. We have a sacrifice. We have a covenant meal. We have God initiating the covenant. Anytime it's a covenant with God, he's the one who's going to be the initiator. But there are some differences between this one and the Abrahamic covenant, and we'll even look at the Noahic covenant just for a minute. This one is different in two regards. The first two, Noah and Abraham, those two were unconditional. This one is conditional. It's based on whether they obeyed or they disobeyed. If they obeyed, there would be blessings. If they disobeyed, there would be curses. So this is a conditional one. The other way it's different from the other two is that the other two were explicitly permanent, everlasting. This one's not. And then the last covenant we're going to touch on today briefly is called the New Covenant. Who initiated this one? Jesus Christ. And with whom? The disciples then and the disciples now. And when he initiated it, he said that the bread symbolized his body. And then he called the cup his blood of the covenant. The blood of the covenant. Again, we have the shedding of the blood. In Luke, it's called the new covenant in his blood. So far today, what we've looked at, I didn't put this on the list of the covenants of God with man because it's not expressly or explicitly a covenant, but I wanted to start with Adam and Eve so that you could see that the sin issue is the sin issue is critical because it is because of the sin and the separation and the fall that God instituted this covenant with man, this covenant of grace, which was his plan before the foundation of the world to save us from eternal condemnation and separation from him. Apart from that, though, we looked at the Noahic covenant, God made it with man, and the beneficiaries were Noah and his family and every other living thing. The Abrahamic covenant God made with Abraham, then he ratified it with Isaac and with Jacob. Then the next one was the Old Covenant, also called the Covenant of the Law. This was made with the nation of Israel through Moses. Unlike the prior two, this one was conditional and not permanent. And then the last one, the New Covenant, is Jesus with believers. On the men with men side, we looked at the covenant that Abraham made, or rather Abimelech made with Abraham, because he's the one who initiated it out of fear of Abraham's God. And then we have the second one that Abimelech also initiated with Abraham's son Isaac, and then the fun one between Laban and Jacob. Now, common elements of covenant. The first thing, spilling of blood, sacrifice of animals, a picture of the innocent dying for the guilty. Then there are promises or oaths. If it's men with men, it can be on both sides. If it's God with man, it won't be that way. Unless it's conditional. Remember that when Moses said, when he read the law and the people said, all that you have commanded, we will do. So they're making an oath, which, well, they didn't keep it very well. Then there can be witnesses or memorials or reminders or signs. Stones were sometimes set up. A tree was planted one time. Another time, seven ewe lambs were given. There can be various witnesses to remind the people that the covenant exists. There are occasionally name changes. We saw that with Abraham and with Sarah. There is usually a covenant meal associated with it. And all the covenants involving God were initiated by God himself. So we need to understand that God's covenant with man is a gift from God, which was ushered in by the death of Christ. But it began way back at the time of the fall with the whisper of the suggestion. Now, because this covenant of grace that we'll be calling by different names comes from God, that means it's inviolable, it's unbreakable, it's unchangeable, and it's irrevocable. Can't revoke it. Romans says, for the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable, and so they are. God says it, it is so. You can go to the bank on it. In spite of human rebellion and sin, God had a plan from before the foundation of the world, a plan of redemption so that he would redeem, he would restore that once perfect relationship that he had had and enjoyed in the fellowship with Adam and Eve before they spoiled it utterly. Such a demonstration of love and grace for man, those of us who deserve nothing but eternal damnation and separation from him, should leave us full of wonder and praise. 2 weeks in a row, you're not going to believe this, 2 weeks in a row, I have not chosen an old hymn. I mean, I've got to go back at least 200 years for a hymn to count, right? This is the second hymn. The last time it was a contemporary song, this one is a hymn that was written only in 1940s, not very old. But it fits. Worthy of worship, worthy of praise, worthy of honor and glory, worthy of all the glad songs we can sing, worthy of all of the offerings we bring, worthy of reverence, worthy of fear, worthy of love and devotion, worthy of bowing and bending of knees, worthy of all this and added to these. You are worthy, Father, Creator. You are worthy, Savior, Sustainer. You are worthy, worthy and wonderful, worthy of worship and praise. Almighty Father, Master and Lord, King of all kings and Redeemer, wonderful Counselor, Comforter, Friend, Savior and Source of our life without end. You are worthy, Father, Creator. You are worthy, Savior, Sustainer. You are worthy, worthy and wonderful, worthy of worship and praise. Amen.